It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at efforts to allow gay men to donate blood in the United States. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin and other lawmakers are calling for an end to a federal ban.
Now, college students are gearing up for school and maybe thinking about their careers and how to prepare for them. A lot of them may get advice along these lines to follow your passion or do what you love and let the money follow.
Our next guest says that's very commonly given advice in the United States, but it's not very helpful. And we want to hear your thoughts. Should we follow our passions to find our career or learn to love the work we do, or is there another way? And you can call and tell your story, too. Did you follow your passion into work? Or did you learn to like it after a while? Or still meh? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Cal Newport joins us now. He's the author of So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work You Love. Cal, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what's wrong with the advice to follow our passion to find our career?
Well, to be clear, the goal of ending up passionate about what you do for a living is a fantastic goal and one I would encourage for all college students. But the specific strategy of first identifying what you're passionate about and then using that to make your career choices is a strategy that actually does a very poor job of describing how most people who end up loving their work actually get there.
And how does that steer us wrong? Is it just that we don't, maybe when we're starting off, we don't know what a workplace should be, we don't have enough information to form a valid passion?
Yeah, it leads us wrong actually in two places. The first place it leads you wrong is if, like the vast majority of college students, you don't have a clear vision for your place in the knowledge work economy, you're going to feel stress and uncertainty and inadequacy. And the second place it leads you wrong is that if you believe that advice, even if you have something you really like, you're going to have this expectation that, well, this is my passion, so I should love it from day one, which is not really what normally happens for people. So when that doesn't come true, all of a sudden you might abandon that path, start job hunting, start becoming uncertain. If you give people an inaccurate vision of how passion develops over time, they're less likely to actually get there.
So I'm really excited to go into Broadway theater, and on day one I'm scrubbing the floor there because that's the only job I can get, and because it so didn't live up to my expectations, I'm gonna be driven out of it?
Yes, or a more common example, you like the idea of being a doctor, that lifestyle seems important and interesting to you, and you find out that the second year of med school or the first year of pre-med is not that fun, and you start wondering, well, maybe this isn't my passion, and I should be a philosopher instead.
Well, on the other hand, if I'm scrubbing floors at the theater in New York City, but I really want to be on stage, am I not pigeonholing myself by getting started in the the housekeeping industry rather than theater?
Well, I think the right way to think about it, so if you go out there and study people who do love what they do and ask them simply, what's your story? What you find is that rare and valuable skill is the key. It's almost unavoidable. The better you get at something in an unambiguous way, the more you're going to enjoy your work, the more passion you're going to have for your work, the more control you have over your lifestyle. So the right way to think about it, I would tell fellow college students, is that you need to say, what are my skill levels? How can I improve those skill levels? That is your currency. You know, that is what's going to get you towards work that you enjoy more and more. The better you are, the better your job.
And you suggest, and this is, I think, attached to what you said, you suggest we adopt a craftsman's mindset. What do you mean by that?
So if we sort of accept the premise that it's skill, unambiguous, rare, and valuable skill that leads people to enjoy their work more and more, this means you have to change the way you think about your working life. Instead of adopting the passion mindset where you say, what is this job offering me? Is this fulfilling all of my interests and passions? You should instead adopt a craftsman mindset where you say, what are my skills? How quickly am I developing those skills? How valuable am I now? How could I be more valuable a year from now? Because the evidence tells us that as those skills increase, there's multiple different traits that begin to reinforce your passion and interest in your career.
Isn't there kind of a chicken or the egg thing here, though? Like, if I'm not interested in this field, whatever field it is, why am I going to start developing the skills? Don't I need a little bit of a nudge there, a little bit of love for it before I start working up that skill set?
Yeah, this is a good question. This is probably the most common question I get when I go out there and speak, because people have heard, you know, Malcolm Gladwell say, you need 10,000 hours before you can become really good. So the assumption, which is a reasonable one, is that I need enough passion for something in advance that I'll actually persist through 10,000 hours or whatever it takes to get good. Now, actually, it turns out the evidence tells us that's not at all the case. And in fact, the more common story when you study people who end up with world-class talent is that they start for serendipitous reasons. Why don't I just choose this activity, or I like my piano teacher, or, you know, my friend's swimming, so why don't I swim? And what happens is, as their skill grows, that gives them more motivation, which allows them to persist to a higher level of skill. And this passion and interest for developing and building the skill tends to snowball along with the skill itself. It does not have to exist in its full form before you get started.
That's how I stumbled into radio.
Me too.
That's funny. Well, to build on this craftsman's mindset analogy, one thing that we think about when we think about craftsmanship is apprenticeship. So, you know, learning the craft alongside someone who's doing it. Do you see that a lot in today's workforce, and how important is it?
I don't think we see enough of that. If we buy the premise that skill is really, you know, the key to this working life that you really enjoy, we should be thinking way more sort of critically and precisely about how do I build skill best. And when you have that mindset, I think it leads you to ideas like apprenticeship, formally or informally. But this notion of, here is someone who is good at this, and I really want to make an effort to understand why they're good at this. What can they do that I can't do? What are the key elements they've built over time? How did they develop them? What can I learn about building skills quickly? I think people, especially young people from my generation, should spend way more time thinking critically about these skill development type questions, and they should replace quite a bit of the thinking they have now about passion type questions. You know, is this what I'm meant to do? What if that's what I'm meant to do? Maybe I should be doing that.
A big part of your book and a lot of what you do outside of the book involves how we gain those skills and the most effective ways to do it. Can you share a couple tips just to refocus us from the wrong ways to learn to the right ones?
Well, the first thing you probably need to do is lock that smartphone in a safe that's hard to open, because we know from the literature on skill development that learning skills requires mental strain, a state where you're pushing yourself past where you're comfortable. It's an uncomfortable sensation. You're pushing yourself past where you're comfortable and giving your full attention and strain to try to persist. And then you get feedback about how well this went or how well that didn't go. This is the type of activity that gives you rapid increase in skills. Now, the problem is, just about the worst thing you can do if you're trying to rapidly develop skills is break your concentration and reduce the strain again and again, which is exactly what happens if you just quickly check the text message, or maybe just see what's going on the Facebook wall, and maybe I need to jump over here to the internet. In other words, the type of behaviors that we have now built around technology are exactly the behaviors you would design if your goal was to minimize the rate at which you pick up complicated skills.
I'm laughing because I'm remembering when I was trying to teach myself trigonometry, but with the TV on in the background, that's a no-no. That was a bad way to learn. Am I hearing this right?
That's right. But it's become, I think, even worse. So I'm 31 years old, which means I am of the last generation, effectively, that went to college without a smartphone or a laptop. So I'm the last generation, really, to have, or the last member of our generation to have that experience of being in a library up in the stacks, you know, working on a paper or organic chemistry, and really having no recourse but to just do the work. And if you want a distraction, you had to actually do a lot of physical effort, go down the stairs, go find someone to talk to. And that's changed now. And all the members of my generation past me don't even get that experience in college, because wherever they are, they have the ability to get quick, semi-personalized interruption, which is like candy for the focus centers of our brain, but devastating for our ability to pick up difficult but valuable skills.
We're talking to Cal Newport. His new book is So Good They Can't Ignore You: Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work You Love.
We want to hear from you. Did you follow your passion to find your career? How did that work out for you? Or did you go into a career without that passion, learn the ropes, and eventually discover your passion for it? You can share your story with us at 1-800-642-1061. 1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
There's more coming up on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up, a look at age discrimination in the workplace and how it affects older baby boomers.
Now we're talking to Cal Newport about his book, So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work You Love. We'll go to the phones now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can call in if you have a story about how you found a job you love, if you followed your passion, or just found out you liked it years later. John in Chippewa Falls will start us off. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Josh, actually, from Chippewa Falls.
Josh, sorry.
No, not a problem. I agree with a lot of what your guest is saying, and we're about the same age. I'm 30, and growing up was told, you know, follow your passion, follow your dream. I pursued print journalism, which was something I had dreamt of doing since I was probably 12. It was successful, but I could see the writing on the wall in the industry, and ended up making a career change about a year ago to the legal field. And what I had to reconcile was this losing, you know, leaving something that's your passion, but also trying to find satisfaction and realizing that a job sometimes is just a job. It's a career, it's important, but it doesn't have to be a part of you. And that's the realization I had to make. And those skills from one career transferred well to the other, so it can work in different ways.
Josh, thanks a lot, and good luck in the new career in the legal profession. What do you make of his story, Cal?
I think it emphasizes an important point. We've heard this advice, follow your passion, so often the last 20 years that we tend to think that, of course, the trait that matters the most for you to enjoy your job is whether or not it matches to an intrinsic or pre-existing interest. We think of that as being obvious, but actually if you turn to the research on workplace motivation or workplace satisfaction, science tells us that, oh no, there's a ton of different traits that are important if you want to really enjoy your work, and it includes things like a sense of autonomy, a sense of competence, a sense of connection and impact. And these are traits that are not connected to a specific job, right? You can have these in many different careers. So when we take a step back from this advice, we say, oh, there's lots of things that matter if I want to enjoy my job. And the notion that it's matched to something intrinsic is actually really not that high on the list. You can build a career you're passionate about without having to pay so much attention to this magical pre-existing intrinsic inclination.
Hmm. Well, you talk about the value of control in the workplace as being an important part of liking our job. How and when should we pursue control over our work environment?
Yeah, this is something that's very clear from the research, that autonomy is crucial. If you have a control over what you do and how you do it, you are going to almost definitely really enjoy what you do. If, on the other hand, you match a job to a passion but have very little control, you're almost definitely going to be miserable about what you do. So gaining autonomy is very important, and I advise in the book and otherwise that you actively pursue it. And I think the important trick there is that autonomy in what you do is crucial, but you have to have skills to back it up first.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to make sure that you have a rare and valuable thing to offer in your field before you try to gain a huge amount of control and autonomy in what you do. If you quit your job to start the yoga studio but don't know much about yoga, you'll have a lot of control, but you probably also won't have much of a paycheck.
Let's go back to the phone. Steven Madison is waiting for us. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I just wanted to put in my two cents about my experience with pursuing my passion. Originally, I dreamt of being a classroom teacher, especially in the grade school realm, and went to school for it and had to have a minor. And I was a little interested in what my minor options were. The one that I chose was library studies. And that led me to a lot of interviews after college. I wasn't getting the interviews for classroom teachers, but I went into each of those interviews for library positions, stating that that was my true passion and hoping to get my foot in the door as a librarian and then be a teacher. And that was about 5 or 6 years ago. And since then, my experience in the library, able to do some teaching, but the other parts of it I've become very, very passionate about.
And so now you're a librarian for life, David? Steve?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly feeling like that's what I would like to do. It's a crazy field to be in at the time with the digitization of everything and what a school librarian is looked at, what is the responsibility of that position, always changing, but it's very exciting to be part of it.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. And Cal, that sounds like what you were talking about. Sometimes we find the career we're passionate about in sort of by serendipity, in this case, a college minor.
Yeah, there seems to be lunacy in asking an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old to lay out a vision for their future, given the extremely limited exposure they may have had to the workspace and what's out there, which is why if I'm talking to, you know, I'm a professor, so I talk with undergraduates. If I'm advising an undergraduate, I'll say, at this age, don't pick a passion, pick a skill. Say, let me try that for a while and see what I can get out of it. And that's actually a way more interesting and probably sustainable path to a really fulfilling career.
Let's go next to David in Lyons. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you for having me on. Say, this is a great topic and one that's near and dear to me, and I think I'm going to roll on with what you just said. What I found when I graduated high school is I had no idea what I wanted to do and no preparation for identifying what I wanted to do. And I think that still carries on now 40 years later. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we do a poor job of helping students at junior high and high school level identify their capabilities and their aptitudes for propensity in a certain direction. Kids will say, girls want to be a microbiologist or a marine biologist to take care of whales, but do they have the aptitude and how practical is it? I guess I'd like to see more help and direction at the younger levels to help begin to search and find yourself.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, David. That's an interesting idea, Cal. What do you think? We don't help young people enough to know what skills they have, inventory those skills, and figure out what they can develop.
We certainly do need more sophisticated conversations surrounding how you choose a career. And I think part of that is looking for aptitude, but I think even more important is actually providing just a clearer, more accurate picture of how aptitude develops over time with attention and how passion develops over time. So it could be just as important to tell a high school student, instead of just saying, well, what are you good at, saying, you don't have to have this clear passion right now, but if you choose something that's interesting to you or something that you have maybe a little bit of aptitude now and you focus on it, here's how that can play out over the next 5 to 10 years. In other words, you need to replace this passion myth with a clear-cut alternative and give a sense of how that unfolds. That's the education that I think we're missing right now in our career conversation.
Well, what if someone has a passion for something and then they go on to discover somehow that their skills don't speak to the strengths that are needed to fulfill that task or to be successful in that career path? What's your advice for someone who kind of feels like, oh, shucks, I can't be that molecular biologist I wanted to be. I'm just not good at chemistry.
Well, the first thing, and I'm being somewhat deliberately provocative here, is that I would say banish the word passion from your vocabulary. It's imprecise and it gets people into trouble. To say, oh, this is my passion, but I don't know if I should follow it. Say, well, what do you mean it's your passion? I mean, what does that mean? Does it mean you're interested in it or you're interested where it could lead you? And really, how strong is that interest versus other things and how much do you understand it? It's a term that can blind you towards a more nuanced reality, but a reality that you can work with better. So for someone in that situation, I would say, no, think of passion as the side effect of a career well managed, where you're good at something and you have control and you work on interesting things. And look at getting those traits. How do I get to those traits? The passion will follow. So change the conversation away from this binary, this is a passion, this isn't, and towards this nuanced vision of a passionate career. When you do that, it tends to solve a lot of these dilemmas.
Time for one more quick call from Anna in Madison. Anna, hi.
Hi.
What's your story, briefly?
Hi. I wanted to add just briefly that I'm a big, I'm really pro-technical college. I did my BA at the UW and then actually went back to MATC for medical interpreting in Spanish. And I really love my job and I just got really lucky. I think there's a lot to be said about not doing a four-year degree, but just kind of immediately going into something that can be useful right away.
And you love what you're doing now, Anna?
I do, yeah. I really do.
Thank you so much for calling. So she went out, she got the skills. Cal, sounds like she could be on the cover of your next book about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the great thing about technical colleges. It makes it clear this skill is valuable and it will have a lot of value in your life. That's the right way to think about things.
So suppose someone asks you to give a commencement address. What's your message to the new graduates in our last 30 seconds here?
I would say choose something that seems interesting to you and then pursue getting very good at it. Let your passion follow you instead of trying to follow your passion. That's the recipe for a meaningful, interesting working life.
Cal, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
That was Cal Newport. His book is So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion and the Quest for Work You Love. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page if you have a story about pursuing your passion in the workplace.
Coming up after the news, an effort to allow gay men to donate blood in the United States after a 30-year federal ban. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk about the discrimination older workers are facing in the workplace and what employers might be able to do about it.
But first, we look at a new effort to reverse a longstanding policy on who can donate blood and who can't.
More than 80 lawmakers, including Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin, are calling on the Obama administration to reverse a policy that prevents gay men from giving blood in the United States.
The policy's been in place since the early 80s, and our next guest says it's outdated and needs to be changed.
Jason Cianciato is Director of Public Policy at the Gay Men's Health Crisis, or GMHC. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, give us some background here. Why was this ban implemented about 30 years ago?
It was implemented in 1983, and we have to remember that back then there was very little known about HIV. In fact, HIV hadn't even been given its name yet. And so the FDA rightfully stepped in and put in place a policy based on the technology available and our knowledge at the time to help ensure that HIV was not being spread through the transfusion of donated blood. In particular, there was a very large population of people with hemophilia who were largely affected, including Ryan White, for whom the Ryan White Care Act was named after. But since then, we've had large advances in technology that enable us to test and find HIV in blood within as little as 7 to 10 days post-exposure. And so we should have a policy that reflects current technology, not the technology of 20 years ago.
Well, under current policy, when I go in to donate blood, I answer a lot of questions. And one of them is, have you had sexual contact with another man since 1977, right?
That's correct.
And then if you answer in the affirmative, they don't want your blood.
That's correct. You are banned for life. And our argument is that not only is that policy discriminatory because it excludes people based on what their particular identity might be, but it also actually doesn't support putting out the safest blood supply available. You know, GMHC is an HIV prevention organization, and our first and primary goal is reducing the spread of infection. So what we want to see happen is for the FDA to institute rules and policies that ask people questions that assess their risk, not necessarily just providing a blanket ban for their identity. So, for example, I've been married for 8 years and in a monogamous relationship for 10. My husband and I are HIV negative, yet I would be banned from donating blood for life. But a heterosexual person could go in and say that he had sex with someone he knew is HIV positive, and he would only be banned for 12 months.
So what would a new system look like? What would it look like if we were to change these things?
We would like a system that is based on what's happening, for example, in countries like Italy and Spain, that have changed policies away from blanket bans to risk-based. So in other words, the questionnaire would be revised, and someone would come in and be asked a series of questions that would help the screener be able to categorize them by a category of risk. We're not calling on the end to all deferral policies. For example, it's entirely plausible that someone might be asked to not donate blood for 12 months, depending on where they traveled or depending on their behavior. And it's also entirely possible that some people might be banned for life based on what they've said. But what we're asking for is for this lifetime blanket policy on all gay and bisexual men to be lifted so that people can be screened based on their risk level.
This seems like it was, as you said, it was justified when it came out. There's still been, is it still erring on the side of caution, which we kind of want in our blood supply, or is this being too cautious, the current policy?
We believe that a transfer or a shift to a risk-based policy would achieve everyone's goals of making sure that the blood supply is as safe as possible and that there's enough available, particularly in times of blood shortage that happened during the summer, and in screening out people regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity who are higher risk, and enabling a large pool of people who are low to no risk to be able to contribute, to be able to give life to people.
What's been the response from groups like Red Cross or other medical organizations?
So the American Red Cross has supported this shift in policy. Recently, the American Medical Association came out, this was just in June of 2013, with a statement saying that the lifetime ban on gay and bisexual men donating blood was not only discriminatory, but also was not based in science. So we have the support of these major medical and health associations, and we just need the FDA to catch up.
And why hasn't the FDA changed this policy, do you think?
Well, they are engaged right now in a very deliberative process where they are waiting for the results of some research studies to come out. But as was stated in the letter that came out of Senator Baldwin's office and signed by 84 members of Congress, the FDA has not updated the public or Congress on the status of these studies, when they can expect the information to be out. And so I'm very grateful that Senator Baldwin and these 84 leaders in Congress are going directly to Secretary Sebelius and the FDA and saying, you know, you need to update us on what's going on, and we need to make sure that this process is moving forward as planned.
With that letter from Senator Baldwin and her colleagues, do you think the Obama administration is going to listen? Do you think this is going to change?
I'm hopeful that it will. The Obama administration has been the most aggressive in history of producing legislation and policy that ends long-time discrimination on people, including lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans. And so they have also been very focused on proper process. So, for example, even though President Obama could have overturned Don't Ask, Don't Tell with an executive order, he believed that it was right for that to come out of Congress, which it eventually did. And so I think that while supportive, the White House is going to sit back and let Congress and the FDA move through on the process that it's supposed to do. And if he feels that it's being held up unreasonably so, I'm confident that he would be supportive of pushing the FDA to move forward.
You mentioned the issue of discrimination. Do you think that this blood supply policy puts a stigma on gay men just by outright banning them for life?
It absolutely does, and I'm glad you raised that because it speaks to another mission-driven issue of why GMHC is taking the lead on this. We have seen time and time again that stigma, whether that's notions of racism, class, or sexual orientation and gender identity, all play a really large role in the transmission of HIV. They create the context in which people aren't equipped to or might, because of mental illness or out of fear, make decisions that aren't the best for their health or for the health of their partners. And so we need to make sure that the stigma that is leading people to believe that there's something inherently wrong with gay people's blood, or that, you know, we should be able to decide whether or not we get transfused gay people's blood, which has been on a lot of commentary and comments I've seen on articles that have come out about this, that our government is leading the way in ensuring that Americans realize that any person who is deemed low risk and wants to give of themselves to give life to people in need should be allowed to do so regardless of who they are.
Jason, if this went into effect tomorrow, or the FDA says tomorrow, okay, we're changing the policy, how long would it take to see the difference at, say, the Red Cross?
That's a really great question. I'm honestly going to say I'm not really sure how long that would take. My hope is that the FDA, as it was previously regarding this research it's involved in, would be very forward and public with leaders, with health leaders, so that and accountable, so that we can make sure that these changes in policy are put out in a way that is responsible, but that also happen in a reasonable time that acknowledges the stigma and discrimination that's happening right now.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Jason Cianciato. He's Director of Public Policy at GMHC.
Coming up next, as more older workers are staying in the workplace, discrimination against them is becoming more and more common. And oftentimes, these slights are subtle and unintentional. We'll talk about recognizing and dealing with age discrimination in the workplace right after the break. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
As more older workers remain on the job, age discrimination is becoming more and more common in workplaces across the country.
Sometimes it's an instance of intentionally hurtful words or actions. Sometimes it's subtle or even unintentional.
Joining us now is Jacqueline James, Director of Research at the Sloan Center for Aging and Work at Boston College. Jacqueline, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So why do you think age discrimination seems to be relatively common these days?
Well, I think it's always been common. I think we're just talking about a little bit more as more people stay in the workforce and people are thinking more about it.
Mm-hmm. And are these, I guess, how is age discrimination manifesting itself now?
Well, there are a lot of perceptions about older workers that I would categorize as discriminatory. One is the idea that they might be ramping down at some particular age. A lot of people think after age 50, the employee is starting to think about retirement and when they're going to leave and looking forward to that. That's one instance. A lot of people think that older workers are less productive for that same reason. They're thinking ahead. They're thinking about getting out the door instead of deepening their engagement with the work. Not as productive as other workers, and we find numerous studies find that just not to be true. Another perception about older workers that we think of as discriminatory is that they're not interested in training or development opportunities or never mind promotions. Some older workers really are. In fact, we have found in some of our research that when older workers are offered training and development opportunities, they are more engaged in their work. This is one of the things that makes older workers happy on the job and happy to be there. And finally, another one that we hear a lot about is that older workers are kind of behind the times in terms of technology. And I think that's the one that I don't have a lot of hard data on, but I would suggest is, you know, in a lot of cases true, but again, it's an unfair assumption because there are a lot of older people who have really gravitated toward technology and are just as savvy with it as some of the younger workers are.
Whose responsibility is it to combat these misconceptions? Is it management? Is it fellow colleagues?
Well, certainly, I think the first step in combating it is becoming aware of it, what it looks like and what it feels like, and learning more about how older workers are experiencing it in the workplace. We know that some 60 to 70% of workers do perceive that age discrimination is going on. So that's a lot of people, and it's important for an organization to get a grip on what that does to the morale in the workplace. And we know from the research that we've done that it is a negative factor in their engagement with their work.
Now, what I heard you describe were more maybe assumptions that you also construed as discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
But how would you formally describe discrimination in the workplace? Are there is it a policy thing? Is it a form of treatment? How would you describe and define discrimination?
Well, actual discrimination is harmful behavior decisions, hiring and promotion decisions based on age.
And some people will make jokes about age, and where do you draw the line between good-natured ribbing and actual discrimination?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Because age discrimination is many things. It can be flagrant. I can decide that I'm not, just not going to hire anyone over a certain age in my organization, or I'm going to make my decision about a layoff strategy based on age. That's flagrant. But it can also be subtle. And the subtle ways are the teasing, the kinds of things that we all do that are considered harmless, making fun of age, those birthday cards and jokes that we make about our own aging. These are some of the more subtle ways. It also can be conscious, like I make an explicit decision about hiring or promotion on the basis of age, or unconscious. I'm not even aware of it. And we have talked in our work about little slights that people perceive in the workplace, like being referred to as a geezer or hearing someone behind you talk about how out of it you are. Or I heard one the other day where people were talking about older drivers as Q-tips because you can't see them over the the wheel of the car. And these are just little nicks that people perceive every day that we have seen as having a negative impact on older workers on the job. And the other thing about this that's difficult is that ageism is different than other kinds of isms that we study. Everybody ages. And it's interesting to note that older people themselves are ageist and guilty of these same kinds of slights, and even sometimes overt discriminatory practices.
I'm a little surprised to hear you talk about people calling one another geezers and Q-tips, I guess, in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's, you know, it is partly discrimination, but also name-calling and unprofessional. I mean, how common is that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know exactly how common it is, words like that, but I do know it's common that people perceive slights like that in the workplace, and we don't have a list of what they are. But that's one of the things that I think organizations need to be doing, is finding out about these kinds of slights that people are experiencing in the workplace.
Well, the AARP reports that 1 in 5 workers between ages 45 and 74 has been turned down for a job because of their age. First, I'm wondering how they collect, if you're able to answer this question, how they collect that data. How do you prove age discrimination when it's not as if an employer is going to outright tell you that you're not hired because of your age?
I am not exactly familiar with that finding, but I would imagine it's based on a perception and not anything that you could prove, and that is one of the difficulties. In fact, even flagrant age discrimination is very hard to prove.
How would you try, I guess, how would you start picking away at that argument?
Which one?
that age discrimination exists.
I guess I wouldn't. I think it does exist, and I think the perception is reality in many respects. But again, it's very hard to prove because, as you say, people are very good at hiding it, even when they are behind closed doors acknowledging the reality of it.
What about potential employees? Does age discrimination make its way into the hiring process at all?
Well, of course, people think it does, and a lot of older people are blogging and writing and talking about how difficult it is to find a job beyond a certain age, and it's always some other excuse. No, but no employer is going to say, I didn't hire you because of your age. But a lot of people, the fact that it is so difficult for people over 55 to get back in the job market once they have been laid off or let go or their jobs eliminated, suggests that there is some age factor going on in decisions that are being made about hiring.
How would you recommend training employees to be more understanding of older workers or more accepting of them?
Well, first of all, I think it's also important to say that young people experience these slights and statements about how they are too young for things. So age perceptions of age discrimination kind of go both ways. So we argue that it's important to think of the workforce as multi-generational and consider the needs of all ages of workers and workers in all stages of life. Some 40-year-olds are just having their first child, and some 40-year-olds are grandparents. And this is not something that people think about a lot. But I would suggest that employers, as a first step, is to become aware that we do live and work in a multi-generational workforce. Probably for the first time in history, there are at least four generations working side by side in the workplace. And it's important to know what their needs are, and people's needs do change over time. And so it's also important to make age a part of any diversity discussion, any assumption about age, including assumptions about younger workers as well. In this way, we avoid pitting generations against each other or younger workers against older workers and vice versa.
What could each generation do to, I guess, in a way, stand up for themselves and prove their worth in the workplace?
Well, I think everybody has to be aware of perceptions of their particular age group and be able to refute those. So there's a lot of advice about, especially the idea that older workers are not up to speed with technology, that we get up to speed with respect to technology, and we're able to demonstrate that if we're in a hiring situation. And for younger workers, if they think they're entitled to a promotion that they've earned, that they have the experience for, then to learn methods for promoting their abilities and speaking to authority about what should be expected of them. And getting age out of the equation, both in the equation and out of the equation, in the equation in the sense that we understand it and know the perceptions that we all have around different ages and stages of life, and out of it by thinking of merit-based approaches to hiring and promotion decisions and deliberately trying to get some of these negative ideas about age out of our heads.
Well, Jacqueline, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jacqueline James is Director of Research at the Sloan Center for Aging and Work at Boston College.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the future of Milwaukee, whether it's on the verge of a renaissance or could be the next Detroit.
We'll talk to the author of You Are Now Less Dumb about ways we can think smarter and avoid common mental errors.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.